Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show planned for you today. My guest this week will be Jo Stepaniak. She is the author of a new cookbook called The Low Food Map. I'm sorry, FODMAP and Vegan book. And she's, you know, the author of numerous groundbreaking books on vegan cuisine, and this is a new one. And we'll talk more about her book and what she's doing in a little bit. But first, I want to go over some things going on in and around the city, some things in the news, share a recipe with you, and that kind of stuff. So right now going on up in Quebec is the World Social Forum, and this is an incredible movement that's been going on since 2001. And the World Social Forum is a group of individuals, society, organizations, social movements that come together to strategize for global and social justice. And it's going on now. They have over 5,000 people presenting and 1,500 activities going on. It's the Global Justice Alliance, and it's up at the University of Quebec in Montreal. It's going on now through the weekend. So is the NOFA Summer Conference this weekend, August 12th through the 14th. That's up at UMass Amherst. That's always an incredible coming together of the NOFA organizations from all of New England. And people come together with great workshops and, you know, great music and food. It's just really very inspiring. I've gone before, and worth going. In the city this weekend, August 13th, at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, from 12 to 8, both Saturday and Sunday, is the New York City African Food Festival. And a day pass is $32. A weekend pass is $53. I think there might be some specials in there too. If you can't afford that, there might be a way to go as well. But it's a wonderful opportunity to taste some great soul food and see what's happening in that movement. On Tuesday, August 16th, I am sponsoring a Thai farm-to-table cooking class here at the IE Green Homestead. It's vegan and gluten-free, and it's Thai-inspired. So we'll be making some coconut curry and some Thai summer rolls. A part of the class is hands-on, but most of it is a demo, and then we sit down to a farm-to-table dinner together. We'll be harvesting the vegetables right from the organic garden here on site. So there's still a few spaces left, so you can sign up on Eventbrite from my website. Also, August 19th is the 5th Annual Food Truck Derby, taking place at the Hayground School out in Bridgehampton. You can just Google the Annual Food Truck Derby and find out more information about that. Although all of these things that I'm mentioning are listed on my website, too. So if you just want to go to one place, you can go to my website, and there's links to everything. Saturday, August 20th is the Vegan Soul Fest. That takes place down in Baltimore, and that's a great coming together of people in the vegan food movement, and it is taking place at the Baltimore City Community College from 12 to 7 on Saturday, August 20th. And one of the founders of that, Brenda Sanders, will be my guest next week on the show. So she'll tell us more about that. August 27th is the Manhattan Holistic Healing Day and Yoga Bazaar. That's a free Holistic Healing Day and yoga event. And it's free. You just need to register. So again, you'll find a link on my website because I don't have down here who's sponsoring that. Gala in the Garden, that's being sponsored by Slow Food East End, and that's taking place at Estia's Little Kitchen on September 10th. September 17th is the 2nd Annual Massive Vegan Potluck. That's taking place in Queens Park, and that's a free event, so more information will be coming out about that. Also, September 30th is the Yale Food System Symposium, which is the 4th annual symposium that's taking place up there on September 30th. The theme is Feeding a Growing World, Perspectives in 2016. They have some great lineup speakers there, so I'll tell you more about that as we get closer to it. So Also, in the news going on right now, there's a new app out, a couple of new apps out that are kind of exciting. One is an app that connects restaurants or connects people with restaurants that have leftover food so that we can keep some 600,000 tons of food out of the landfill. And it was developed in the UK, and they just launched it. I'm not sure if it's actually working here or not. I'll need to look into that and let you know about that. But then also, there was a great article in the New York Times about a co-op building that has a big roof garden on it, and how more, you know, that one's in Long Island City, but how more and more developers are including rooftop gardens. And I just thought that was exciting. And amongst all the bad news that we always have, I thought it would be really nice to include something that's a little bit more positive. There's also a new Bicot app. It's really great. You can download it and then use your smartphone or iPhone to scan products in the supermarket and find out who the parent organization is and whether or not they support GMO labeling, fair labor rights, you know, all kinds of different things. So you can kind of find out the philosophy of the parent organization and know whether or not you want to support that product and possibly make a different decision based on that information. Unfortunately, it does work only with a smartphone, so it does limit who can use it, but it's still a great app. And then there was a great ad that I put on my website that about Pepsi, one that they don't want you to see. They launched a new campaign about Crystal Pepsi, which is a product that they used to have out, and they've relaunched it. And there's a great ad, you know, about the palm oil that they use to make the product and how that's decimating our rainforests. And, you know, they are greenwashing the way that they are advertising themselves, which so many companies do. You know, on one aspect, they're putting money into using only sustainably raised palm oil, but that's only a portion of what they use, and then they buy other palm oil through a third party so that it doesn't show up, so that you can look and see, oh, they're only buying sustainable, but they're really buying it also from a third party. And so many corporations do that. You know, I'm over and over telling people you really have to follow the money to really find out the truth, because it's so easy for companies to greenwash. And yet at the same time, as I'm in this food movement world for so long, I see that a lot of nonprofits need to partner with some of these companies. Like, I know Pepsi also has a leg of their organization called Pepsi for Good. And they are delivering fresh fruits and vegetables to bodegas in different parts of the country. And they're doing that while they're delivering the poison Pepsi that they deliver. But nevertheless, the end result is that they are getting some fruits and vegetables into bodegas that otherwise wouldn't have those fruits and vegetables, and that's a good thing. So, you know, it's complicated as all of these things are. Nothing's really simple. So you just really have to look into it, do the research, and, you know, follow your heart and do what feels right. There's no, you know, hard edges. There's no real clear black and white. There's so many gray edges there. So we all have to do the best that we can, but we all have to really take up these issues. We need to pay attention to the food. We need to pay attention to what's in our food. We need to pay attention to transparency. We need to see who's making the money. And, you know, and seeing who's being honest. So anyway, we all have work to do in this, and some of these apps and stuff are just making it a little easier for us. I want to share a recipe with you before I invite Joe on to talk with us some more. The recipe this week is sweet stuffed peppers. I'm harvesting so many peppers out of my garden, all different sizes, shapes, and colors, that I thought this would be a great recipe to share with you. Every time I make a recipe, you know, rather than going into my old recipes and pulling it out and making it, I'm always creating new recipes. I love to do that. They're similar. I borrow from each other, but they're never the same. And that's something that I really am hoping as I share my recipes with you, that you all become more comfortable in the kitchen. We all need to get into the kitchen, become comfortable with it so that we can be creative. Recipes sometimes can be restrictive. And, you know, I like to encourage everybody that if you don't have an ingredient in the recipe, that does not mean you don't make the recipe. Use something else. You know, it's like if you're using a dark leafy green, you can substitute pretty much any dark leafy green. If you don't have a Vidalia onion, use a red onion or a white onion. You know, there's so many different things that you can substitute. So be flexible and have fun. That's really the important thing. And put in what you like and leave out what you don't. That's another beauty of being the person behind the food in the kitchen. Okay, so these sweet stuffed peppers, the filling can fill 8 to 10 peppers depending on the size of the peppers. Mine were pretty large. I think I actually got 9 out of this recipe. So then 2 onions that I chopped, 2 carrots that I diced, 1 red pepper that I diced, 2 portobello mushrooms cut into large chunks, 2 cups of, I used tat soy because that's what I had, but I also have lots of other leafy greens. So really 2 cups of any leafy greens, press it, you know, chop it first and press it down into a measuring cup. You can certainly put in more if you want to put in more. 1/4 cup of chopped parsley, 1 tablespoon chopped garlic, 1 teaspoon salt, 2 tablespoons dill chopped, 2 teaspoons thyme chopped, 3 tablespoons tamari, 1/2 teaspoon pepper, 1 can of cannelloni beans. You can substitute out another bean. I've used chickpeas in this recipe too. Adduki beans are good. So you can really, you know, substitute if you don't want cannelloni beans or don't have them. 3 cups of cooked organic brown rice. And then for the sauce, you need I used 1 1/2 onions chopped, 1 carrot grated, 1 1/2 cups cherry tomatoes, 2 peppers chopped, 1 cup of raisins. I use organic for those because, remember, grapes are on the dirty dozen list, so you really want to use organic raisins. 1/2 cup of organic brown sugar, 3 14-ounce cans of organic diced tomatoes. If you have lots of cherry tomatoes, you can use those instead. I just didn't want to use all my cherry tomatoes up. 1/4 cup of red wine vinegar, 1 1/2 teaspoon salt, 1/2 cup of water, 1/2 teaspoon pepper, and then 1 cup of pine nuts. And so for the sauce, I put that on first. I cooked the onions in some olive oil over medium heat, and I used a heavy Le Creuset pot, you know, a cast iron pot that has an enamel coating, or any other heavy-duty pot that can sit on the stove for a while and cook, because I'm actually, you know, I cooked the sauce in this big pot, and then I put the peppers right into it, and we're going to cook the peppers on the stovetop. You can cook it in the oven if you prefer. But the stovetop is kind of nice because what happens is as it's kind of like a tagine. As it cooks and boils, the juices keep dripping back down onto the peppers, and so it kind of self-simmers, and it's just really great. So for the sauce, you're going to cook the onions in the olive oil. Then you're going to add the carrots, peppers, and cherry tomatoes and cook that for a couple minutes until it cooks down a little bit. Then you add the remaining ingredients. Bring it to a boil, then reduce the heat and let it simmer for about 30 minutes. And that can be simmering while you're making the filling for the peppers. And so for the fillings, I sautéed the onions in olive oil again until translucent. Then I added the carrots and cooked that for a few more minutes. I added the peppers, the mushrooms, and the tat soy and cooked that for a few more minutes. Until, you know, the greens really kind of wilted and became soft. Then I added the remaining ingredients and cooked that for a few more minutes, allowing all the flavors come together. You know, lastly, you know, I stir in the brown rice and just mix it all up. Taste it and adjust the seasoning to your liking. If you need to add more salt and pepper, do that. A little bit more tamari, you know, play with the filling so that it's what you like. Then I stuff the peppers. You cut off the tops of the peppers and scoop out the seeds and the ribs from inside. I actually used a grapefruit spoon. That really works well because it has a little bit of you know, serrated edge on the tip of the spoon. And I get the ribs of the peppers out that way. And then I filled each pepper all the way up. I don't put the top back on. I just then place the peppers standing up in the pot that has the sauce in it. And about 9 peppers fit pretty snugly. I could have certainly gotten a 10th in there. But depending on the size of your pot, you know, you want to stand the peppers up. I took a scoop of the sauce and put a little scoop of the sauce on top of each pepper, covered it, and let that simmer for about 1 hour on the stovetop. And every, you know, 15 minutes or so, I just checked the bottom center to make sure it wasn't sticking and gave it a little bit of a stir carefully not to disturb the peppers, recovered it, and let it cook some more. And it's just delicious. You can serve it on a platter with some extra rice if you want on the side, or just a big tossed salad. It's really beautiful, and it's a great summer recipe to use up all those tomatoes and peppers coming out of the garden. So enjoy it. Please give me feedback. I love hearing how you like it and what you maybe did to personalize it and make it your own. And so now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Jo Stepaniak. She is the author of numerous groundbreaking books on vegan cuisine, health, and compassionate living. She's dealt with a multiple of food sensitivities in her life and chronic digestive issues, and understands firsthand the challenges of living with dietary restrictions. So her new book, The Low FODMAP and Vegan Cookbook, is her goal to help vegans, regardless of their health or dietary obstacles, live by their values with joy and not fear. And so, Jo, are you with me?
I'm here. Good morning.
Thank you for joining me. So I wanted to really start with some basics, because I think, you know, people have heard of so many diets. You know, there's always new diets. There's the, you know, gluten-free diet is really big now, low-carb diets everyone's heard of, macrobiotics diets, vegetarian, vegan, pescatarian. But FODMAP is a new one. I think a lot of people have not heard about the FODMAP diet. So could you first share with us what FODMAP stands for? I know it's an acronym. And then tell us what a low FODMAP diet is.
Sure. You're right, it's an acronym, and it stands for complicated words that most people won't want to pronounce, but it's fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. And those are short-chain carbohydrates that are found in a great number of predominantly plant-based foods. And the research on FODMAPs has been going on for probably decades, mainly out of Australia from Monash University. And in the past several years, the research has become more intense and more widely exposed. So although the average person hasn't heard of FODMAPs and doesn't know what they are, people who have IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, and other chronic digestive issues are becoming aware of it and becoming aware of how a low FODMAP diet can help them feel better. Essentially, these low FODMAPs, well, FODMAPs in general, cause issues for most people, but to a very minor degree when they eat foods that are high in them. And so a diet that has a lower number of high FODMAP ingredients will help people who have digestive issues feel better by not triggering their symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes sense.
So it seems like it's especially challenging for someone who's a vegan, because so many of the foods that are high in FODMAPs are, like you said, plant-based foods.
So, right, exactly. And these are the foods, you know, we tend to think of legumes, lentils, peas, and beans as foods that generally cause gas and some other issues for the majority of people. But for those who have irritable bowel syndrome and chronic digestive issues, they can be huge triggers for symptoms. And those are a big part of a vegan diet.
Right.
And there are a number of other foods that make it especially challenging for vegans because they are part of almost every prepared or packaged item imaginable. I was listening to your wonderful recipe, and I was thinking about, well, what are the FODMAPs in that? And two of the really big triggers that are high in FODMAPs especially are onions and garlic.
Right. And I use onions and garlic in almost everything.
And everybody does. It's sort of people can't cook without it. And I have tips in the book on how to get those same wonderful flavors without using the high FODMAP ingredients. So if you read the book, you'll see that, well, you may not be able to have onions, but you can have scallion greens, for example.
And what about, chives. I've heard also you can infuse oil with onions and garlic, and then for some reason that doesn't transfer over the FODMAP. Is that true?
Right. You can do that. You just have to be really careful with it. It's better to buy an oil that's already prepared because there's risk of contamination when you make it yourself and try to store it.
Mm-hmm.
But
and
yes,
what about garlic or onion powder? Would that be a problem?
Oh, yes, that's a problem too.
It is?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yes. Yeah, you want to, if, now, people who have digestive issues and irritable bowel syndrome have different triggers from each other. So what triggers my symptoms may not trigger those in someone else. But high FODMAP foods, in general, tend to be trigger foods for almost everyone. But they may vary from person to person. The vast majority of people with IBS do have a sensitivity to onion and usually garlic as well. And because they're so ubiquitous, they're very hard to avoid. Those are the biggies. But there are other foods that are high in FODMAPs that one person might be affected by and another person may not. So the diet is, it's not really a permanent diet, but what it is a way to figure out what your triggers are and narrow them down, because without this guidance, it becomes almost impossible to figure out what your triggers are because there can be so many. And then once you figure those out, you can eliminate those from your diet or just have them in small portions. Because when it comes to digestive issues like IBS, portion and size really matters.
Right, so you could tolerate a little bit, but not too much.
Right, and some foods you may not be able to tolerate at all. Onion is often a problem no matter what amount there is. Other foods are problematic as well. Almost all legumes are problematic, but small amounts of lentils and small amounts of chickpeas are better tolerated than most other legumes. And canned legumes, particularly lentils and chickpeas, are better tolerated than home-cooked.
Mm-hmm.
So there are all kinds of tips and tricks that I cover in the book that guide people so that they can help manage their symptoms as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know, you know, just as a natural food chef myself, I know when I cook beans, I'll cook them with kombu, you know, seaweed to help with the gas. Have you experimented with that? Does that help at all?
I have experimented with that. It doesn't help. And the reason is because the FODMAPs are still there. And they're in the liquid and they're in the beans. And when a canned bean, just because of however they're processed, has a lower level of the FODMAPs, but they should also be thoroughly rinsed if you're using canned beans. There really aren't a lot of tricks in terms of getting rid of the FODMAPs in foods. Certain things help reduce the FODMAP level. such as fermentation, as with sourdough bread. So wheat is another food that is very high in FODMAPs. It's not the gluten. It's the carbohydrate. So the gluten is the protein, but it is the rest of the wheat, that's the carbohydrate portion, that is high in FODMAPs. So if you're vegan, you can have, and you have IBS, you can have gluten, seitan, if it doesn't contain onion and garlic and other high FODMAP seasonings. But having a slice of wheat bread might be problematic. However, having a slice of sourdough, 100% sourdough wheat bread, may not be problematic. And that's because the process of fermentation during the sourdough process decreases the FODMAPs.
Very interesting.
The fermentation basically consumes the FODMAPs. I know, it's very science-based, and it is very fascinating.
And can you tell us again, where did this come out of? Like, how did someone discover this?
Well, they've known about FODMAPs. Scientists and researchers have known about FODMAPs, as I said, for decades. And they were aware that they were in certain foods, such as legumes. But they began more in-depth research as money became available for it out of Monash University in Australia. And they discovered that this is a source of a problem that triggers symptoms in people with digestive issues. So it's not just beans in general, but it's the FODMAPs in beans, the FODMAPs in particular foods. But they're only able to test certain foods as money becomes available for the research. It's been limited. But they've been able, fortunately, to do testing on a lot of foods, but there are still foods that have not been tested, so we don't know if they're high in FODMAPs. And so people with IBS sort of need to experiment with those that haven't been tested to see if they're triggers for them.
Uh-huh. So for a vegan, you know, foods like tofu, tempeh, well, tempeh is fermented, so is tempeh better than tofu, or both of them, because they're made from soybean, are not good?
Well, it's an interesting question. Whole soybeans are not good. So soy milk made from whole soybeans will generally cause problems for most people with IBS. Foods that, like edamame, that can be problematic, especially in large amounts. However, tofu is fine because the FODMAPs have been drained off when the tofu is being made. So the solids are separated from the tofu whey, from the whey in the soy milk that is used to make tofu. And tofu, especially when it's very firm and the more liquid from it has been removed, the lower in FODMAPs it will be. And tempeh, even though it's made with the whole bean, you're right, because it's fermented, it's lower in FODMAPs. So those are two safe foods for most people with IBS.
Wow, interesting. It's so complicated. I mean, I pulled up before this interview, you know, a high FODMAP list, you know, of things to avoid. And it's just, it seems thicker than the list I have for the low FODMAPs. It's huge.
Well, it is. But if you look in the book, I have lists, and some of the lists on what's safe are actually pretty lengthy. There's a lot of misinformation on the web. So I don't encourage people to look, because you'll see lots of lists that contradict each other.
Right.
And what I have in the book is the most current, up-to-date information available, and it's accurate. It's straight from the university's research. So when they go to the book, when readers go to the book, they will find the most current information possible, and they will find the clearest instructions on how to follow a low FODMAP diet and while being vegan. And what I find particularly interesting is that many people say, well, you know, a low FODMAP diet is so restrictive. And in many ways it is. There are lots of things that you need to learn, about your own triggers and what to avoid. However, there are lots of things we can have, and that's what's important to educate ourselves about. For instance, we may not be able to have apples, but we can have grapes. We may not be able to have watermelon, but we can have honeydew and cantaloupe. We may not be able to have blackberries, but we can have strawberries, and we can have blueberries, and we can have raspberries. So there's really a lot that
now
we can have.
Can you explain as a layperson, I'm like, this diet is relatively new to me. I have cooked for some people. You know, I cook for people with different dietary issues, and I have cooked for some people with FODMAP issues. But, like, the difference between a raspberry or a strawberry or a watermelon and a cantaloupe, I mean, they're all high in fructose. What is it that makes one okay and not the other?
It's the FODMAP content.
Wow.
It's not just the fructose. It's the FODMAP content.
Right. So there's nothing that you can – it's almost like you have to memorize it. There's nothing that you can – you know, like – vegan's clear, you know, if it's from an animal, you can't eat it, you know. You know, macrobiotic is kind of clear. You know, there's certain diets that are, there's rules that are very clear. In a FODMAP diet, you really have to almost carry your list around with you until you learn it. I'm sure if you are living with it day in, day out, eventually you're going to kind of learn it. But it's, is that correct?
You do learn it. It's what you need to do is follow the low FODMAP diet for a short period very strictly, and then you can gradually add foods back and see if they trigger your symptoms. And if they don't, then great, you can have them. And if they do, then you add that to your list, your personal list,
uh-huh,
of what you need to avoid. But bear in mind that fortunately, IBS is not a deadly disease. It can be terrible. It can really affect a person's quality of life greatly, and that shouldn't be minimized. It can be a very problematic issue for people who are affected by it seriously. However, like I said, it's not a death sentence. It doesn't progress into cancer or to other more serious progressive diseases. So that's a good thing. What happens when we eat a food that causes symptoms for us is that we feel really awful, and we might feel really awful for several days, or we might even not feel awful immediately. It might not happen until a day or two after we've eaten a food, which is another reason why it's so hard to figure out our triggers. But so if you go to a party and you have something that is high in FODMAPs and, geez, you know it's a trigger for you, you're just going to feel bad for a while, but you'll recover. So it's not that horrible in terms of, well, you're going to be sick forever if you eat something that's high in FODMAPs. But if you want to feel good, you want to avoid those foods.
Right, you're not
going to
go into anaphylactic shock, but you are, you know, but you just won't feel good. So you recommend doing it kind of like an elimination diet, like one would do with an allergy diet, where you cut it all out to start and then slowly, you know, reintroduce a food and pay attention to how you feel afterwards.
And, right.
Mm-hmm.
And this does is give people guidance. There are some people who need to stay on a fairly strict low FODMAP diet for a long period. And there are some people who just need to sort out what their specific triggers are, and they might not be very many. For other people, there might be a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
So would this be good
for someone who has Crohn's disease too?
Is that
the same kind of digestive issues? Uh-huh.
It's primarily for people with irritable bowel syndrome, but any kind of chronic digestive disorder will benefit from a low FODMAP diet, and that includes people with IBD, Crohn's, and ulcerative colitis. So if this is not a cure, and it's not going to make the problem go away, but what it will do is help minimize triggers, and that can exacerbate symptoms.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I was looking this up before our interview, you know, there was a lot of information that said, you know, you don't do it by yourself, don't try to attempt this by yourself, have the guidance of a dietitian. Is that just like scare tactics, like, you know, them trying to get, you know, get your business and keep, you know, I mean, every time they say follow a dietitian, I always think, well, it's the dietitians that, you know, designed the meal plan in the hospitals and the school lunch program, so stay away from them. You know, I don't see them as a wonderful thing. So what's your take on it?
I think in part you're right. When people become vegan, they often hear, well, you're going to be missing out on so many nutrients. You really need to talk to a dietitian. You really need to sort this out because you're going to be nutrient deficient and you're going to have all kinds of health problems. We hear that all the time.
Right, right.
And that is true. You will hear that all the time. If you mention to anybody or if a physician recommends that you go on a low FODMAP diet, they will also recommend that you talk with a dietitian. However, if you're already vegan and you're already familiar with good, whole, healthy foods, then you should be able to figure out with the guidance in the book how to have a wholesome, nutritious, balanced diet that's low in FODMAPs. Because as I said, you may not be able to have one type of food, but you can have another. For example, you may not be able to have black beans or white beans, but you might be able to tolerate lentils and chickpeas. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can have tempeh, you can have seitan, you can have tofu, you can have kale and collards, and you may not be able to have Brussels sprouts, but you can have those. So, you know, there are so many options that we have. And so if you already have a nutritious vegan diet, my personal view is that if you follow the guidelines in the book, you don't need to go to a dietitian to get further guidance.
Right. Let's take a couple-minute break. And when we come back, I actually want to delve a little bit more into the book and talk about some of the recipes you have in there and, you know, some more of the foods that you really recommend for people that are vegan that do need to eat a low FODMAP diet, okay?
Sounds great.
Everyone listening, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Joe Stepaniak, who came out with a new book, The Low FODMAP and Vegan Diet. Be right back.
Host of the Maria Heller Show, heard at MariaMeria.net 4 days a week. But every Sunday at 3 p.m. Eastern, you get to hear one of the best shows of the week on the Maria Heller Show right here on PRN.fm. If you missed the show, they're archived right here on site at PRN. Support Real Truth in Media by tuning in and sharing the information you hear with anyone that'll listen. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
This is journalist Dave Lindor. I'll be hosting the show This Can't Be Happening each Wednesday at 5 p.m. Eastern on PRN.fm. Because we know it is happening, each week's program will feature some issue that's been getting ignored or misreported, like Social Security, climate change, military spending, or the government's destruction of the Internet. Please join me at This Can't Be Happening on Wednesday at 5 p.m. Eastern.
Join the movement at PRN.fm, your best source for progressive programming.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Joe Stepaniak. She is the author of the new cookbook, The Low FODMAP and Vegan Book. What to Eat When You Can't Eat Anything. Wait, what is it? I'm sorry. When you can't eat anything. That's right. What to Eat When You Can't Eat Anything. So, you know, if you're vegan and you already feel like you're on a limited diet and then you have to follow the low FODMAP diet, it becomes that much more challenging, and Joe is here to tell us how to manage that. Is you with me, Joe?
I'm here, Bhavani.
Great. So yeah, the tagline to your book is great. What to eat when you can't eat anything. That's perfect. It must feel like that when you first discover that, you know, someone saying to you, you're vegan already, and then someone saying you need to cut out all foods that are high in FODMAPs. I'm sure people's first feeling is like, oh my God, what do I eat now?
Oh, yeah. But also, before people were aware of FODMAPs, it felt like everything was a trigger. And I've been in that position where no matter what I ate, it seemed that it caused my symptoms and made things worse. And so I felt all I could have was air and water, and that was about it. So actually discovering the low FODMAP diet and adapting it for vegans was a blessing for me, because I could find what I could eat.
Right. Because now all of a sudden, that's a great way to look at it, because now all of a sudden it actually gave you more freedom, because even though you had boundaries, you knew within those boundaries you had freedom.
Right. Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's how I view it. And I wanted to give people options in the book in terms of the recipes for things that it's really almost impossible to find. For example, ketchup and barbecue sauce and sriracha sauce, things that we love to use to season our foods, have FODMAPs in them. They all have garlic or onions or both. So I gave options in the book for recipes for these that are really easy to make, because I'm all about easy, and lots of seasoning choices, lots of main dish recipes and staples that people can turn to. And the point about being easy is really essential, because when you don't feel good and you need to eat something but you don't feel like it and you don't know what you can have, I wanted to have comfort foods, things that you could put together quickly or that would store well, so that they're easy to have on hand when you know you need to eat, when you're feeling hungry but nothing seems appealing, that they're there and they can be soothing and comforting.
Uh-huh. What can you share with us one of your favorite comfort food recipes from your book?
Oh, my. Well, let's see. I'd have to. I wasn't prepared for that. One of the things that I like that's super simple is my lemon pepper tofu, and that's, you can use that in so many things. You can put it into strips and put it on top of a salad, or put it in one of my bliss bowls, which is just a bowl dish that has a grain as the center and vegetables and a sauce that you can adapt a bazillion ways. You can use it in a sandwich if you have low FODMAP or gluten-free bread. You can put it on crackers that are low in FODMAP. So it's a really good recipe to make and to store and to keep on hand, especially if you're feeling really hungry and you just want something, you know, grab a quick slice of something that's flavorful. And this recipe, it calls for 1 pound of super firm or extra firm tofu pressed. And the super firm tofu, if you're able to find it, is exceptional, because it's extremely firm, which means that the majority of liquid has been pressed out of it, and that lowers the FODMAP content. I also have instructions in the book for how to press tofu to make it, if you can't find a super firm tofu, to make it as firm as possible. And that will not only make it tastier, but it will make it lower in FODMAPs. And mm-hmm. the recipe calls for 5 tablespoons of lemon juice, 1 tablespoon of extra virgin olive oil, 1 tablespoon of reduced sodium tamari. I prefer the reduced sodium just because I find that too much of anything, whether it's sugar or whether it's salt or whether it's fat, exacerbates my symptoms. And so I recommend a reduced sodium tamari, which I find is just as flavorful as the full sodium tamari.
Mm-hmm.
1.5 teaspoons of ground pepper, 1 teaspoon of dried thyme that's crushed between your fingers, 1 teaspoon of grated lemon zest, if you've got it, that's optional, and 1 teaspoon of balsamic vinegar.
Mm.
And then you just cut the tofu into slices, 1/4 to 1/2 inch thick, however thick you prefer it, and oil a large roasting pan, put the tofu in the pan in a single layer. Don't let the slices touch, though, because they'll stick together and they won't cook properly. And then just put all those other ingredients into a small bowl or jar and whisk them together or seal the jar and shake it. Pour it over the tofu. Let it marinate for 30 minutes at room temperature, occasionally tilting the pan so the tofu stays covered. And then bake it at 350 degrees for 30 minutes. And that's it.
Mm, sounds great. Sounds great.
It's easy and it's surprisingly flavorful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, tofu is one of those foods that is just so versatile because it really has no flavor by itself. So you can give it whatever flavor you want as long as you cook it well. And so do you cook it so that it, does it come out kind of golden brown on the edges?
It's golden brown on the edges, and, of course, if you like it chewier, you can bake it a little longer.
Mm-hmm.
Really, the recipes are so easily adapted to anybody's personal taste, and I've got lots of variations with the recipes, too. And, you know, it's funny to think of what are my favorites. They're actually all my favorites. I really wanted to create recipes that I could make and that I would enjoy, too, because I have IBS, and I don't feel good a lot of the times. So I wanted to have recipes that I could turn to. And I totally understand what it's like to not feel good, to not feel like cooking, you know, what a pain it is to pull everything out and you know you have to eat. And so I wanted to have things that were easy and actually fun to make, too.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, I'm happy to see that many of the grains still are good. It's pretty much wheat is the one that seems to be problematic. But you still can have quinoa. You can still have rice. You can have buckwheat. Other than wheat, is there other grains that are really...
Barley and rye. The ones that are high in gluten.
Right.
Even though gluten's not the problem, but those are the grains that are problematic for most people with IBS. And the diet is actually very good for people who have celiac disease as long as they buy gluten-free, certified gluten-free products and avoid seitan. So it works really for the vast majority of people who have chronic digestive issues regardless of what they are.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And what about dark leafy green vegetables? I know a lot of them are considered high. Which ones?
Actually, you can have kale and collard greens and, of course, you know, all the baby lettuces and tapsoi, one of my favorites, bok choy. There are plenty. There are actually very few. You can have broccoli. There
oh,
are
really?
Few
I thought
that you
I'm sorry. I thought broccoli was one of those ones that you couldn't have.
Well, that's the problem with looking at the list online. It,
right.
It actually is okay within certain quantities.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you can have broccoli. You can have romaine lettuce and arugula, one of my favorites. So many.
Is there a difference between eating how it's digested or how the FODMAPs are, whether you eat them raw or cooked, or is that kind of the same?
It's pretty much the same. Except some people who have very delicate digestive systems have more trouble eating raw food than they do cooked. So if somebody has a problem with that, they can just veer more toward the cooked foods. And some people have a problem with too much fiber. A lot of the old wives' tale advice was, well, if you have IBS, just eat more fiber. And that can be so dangerous for some people. So sometimes we need to cut back on our fiber intake. And cooked foods can help in that regard.
Uh-huh, right. And now mushrooms are also considered high. Are all mushrooms the same?
Or yes.
They
all are. Mushrooms, yeah. Yeah, all mushrooms are high in FODMAPs. But again, some people may find they can have a very small amount. They might be able to have one mushroom, and it's not a problem. But, it, you know, really, it's a very personal, individualized thing. But the foods that tend to be high in FODMAPs are the ones we want to eliminate initially and then add back very gradually to see if we can tolerate them. But that's one biggie. Dates, cashews. These are foods that are so prevalent in the majority of vegan recipes these days,
right.
And they are high in FODMAPs. And that's what makes it a challenge, learning what to avoid.
Well, also, like, grapes are one of the ones that you're not supposed to have.
Grapes
you said you can have, but raisins,
yes.
you can't,
but raisins,
right?
You cannot, right.
So,
and
exactly. So what is the difference there?
They're concentrated. Raisins are concentrated because they're dried. Dried fruits are higher in FODMAPs because everything is concentrated. So, yes, those are things you have to bear in mind.
So then I would guess wine is off the list, right?
No, wine is actually okay, except for certain ones. Certain ones such as sticky wine, and there's a low glycemic wine that are higher in FODMAPs. But really, alcohol in moderation is okay, except for rum. But alcohol can be an IBS trigger in general, just as caffeine can be, just as sugar can be, just as fats can be. So you want to minimize those. It's not that you can't have them, but have one glass and have it with food.
Right. Uh-huh. Right, because I would have thought that would have been concentrated too, just like the raisins. Right? And, you know, that's
think.
The thing. It follows different rules than your average intuition.
Yeah. But some of it, I mean, you really do get, when you have to follow a low FODMAP diet, when you have chronic digestive disorders, you do start to memorize what you can and can't have and what works and doesn't work for you.
Mm-hmm.
And it does become second nature in just the same way that vegan foods do when you become vegan.
Right, right. So what other recommendations or advice do you have for vegans with IBS who are trying to minimize FODMAPs in their diet?
Well, I recommend the book, of course, and I give suggestions on how to deal with eating out, how to deal with events. And I also have a website dedicated to this, ibsvegan.com. That's ibsvegan.com. And I have a blog there with lots of updated information. I also have a news section where I'm posting the latest scientific updates and news updates regarding IBS. And lots of information also about FODMAPs, what's safe and what isn't safe. So I suggest visiting the website. I also suggest getting the book and I also suggest not worrying that there is support. I'm here to give support. The book provides support, and people need to know they're not alone. The hardest thing is feeling like you're the only one, and IBS affects 10 to 15% of the population, not just in the U.S., but worldwide. So when you go to a group, let's say a vegan gathering, you've got to remember 10 to 15% of the people there are going to have IBS.
That's unbelievable. I had no idea.
Visible. And it might even be more, because people who tend to go toward more healthful diets are often people who have digestive issues to start with, and they're looking for something to help them. So there might even be a higher percentage than that at vegan gatherings. But it's such a difficult topic to talk about. It's not a party conversation item. So it's hard to find each other.
Right, right. So you said you're also there for support. On your website, is there a place where people can actually ask you a question?
People can send in questions. I can't respond to people personally, but if somebody has a question that they think would be appropriate for one of the blog topics, I can cover it in a future blog. And, of course, you can respond to the blogs in the comment area. If somebody would like to see a topic covered, they're welcome to send that in to me, and they can subscribe to the blog on the site. So they'll always stay updated. Again, it's ibsvegan.com.
So, and is the book available everywhere? Like, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, that kind of thing?
Yep, wherever books are sold. It's Low FODMAP and Vegan. That's the title.
That's great. Well, you know, Joe, as you, I'm sure you already know and you've heard this from other people, you are filling a much-needed space for not just vegans, but for people with IBS, because even if someone is not a vegan, learning to eat, as you said, whole grains, you know, a natural way. I mean, I'm always blown away by, you know, hearing people who are on a gluten-free diet who are buying these gluten-free products that are made with crap, you know, and it,
yeah,
you know, that can't be good for them. And, you know, those that are on a healthy diet to start with know that. And so it's a challenge, you know, and I am always, you know, trying to encourage people to really do their own research because, like you said, even for me, if you go to the, if you just look online, you're going to see a generic list. It's not always going to be accurate. And the minute I hear, you know, red flags go up for me when I hear them saying, oh, don't do it without the, you know, professional advice from a dietitian. I'm like, all right. Let's not believe them. Yeah, so I think, you know, I think it's very doable. But you just, you really need to pull up a list or, like you said, get your book and use those guides because it's not intuitive. You can't say, oh, well, since this bean is no good, that bean's no good, when, you know, I would have assumed tofu and tempeh was probably not good. So, and seitan, you know, I thought all three of them would have been bad, but it's great. I mean, that actually opens so many doors, the fact
right,
that you can
does.
Do that. And
yeah.
I even saw cornflakes are great. And, you know, cornflakes are great breading for tofu. You know, I do corn-encrusted tofu cutlets all the time, you know, and put different sauces on it. And that, you know, that just brings, like, a crunchiness, kind of like a fried chicken would have, you know, to someone, you know, who's, you know, craving more of a crunchiness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just grinding up some cornflakes is a great breading. And so I was happy to see that you could use that, too. Anyway, we're just about out of time. So, Joe, I just want to thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you, Bonnie.
You're welcome. And everybody out there who's been listening, thank you so much for joining us. Have a great rest of the week. And I'll see you again next week. Bye for now.